May it please the court.
Counsel, before you begin, just a housekeeping issue. We know that there is some sealed material in this
yes,
case.
Yes, Your Honor.
No one has asked us to close the courtroom, and we have not done so. However, if in the course of argument you think there is a reason why you should delve into that material, let us know and we can accommodate you.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's certainly the United States' hope that we can direct the court to the briefs if necessary in that respect. May it please the court, David Goodham for the United States. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Using AK-47s and an RPG, defendants, Confederates, seized on the high seas the ship, the Future, and its crew. The defendant, Mr. Ali, thereafter joined his Confederates and on their behalf negotiated a ransom of $1.7 million. Regardless of whether defendant Ali ever acted on the high seas, he committed piracy in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1651 when he aided and abetted the actions of his violent conspirators. The district court reached the opposite conclusion, concluding that this violated international law. Domestic law, the interaction between Section 2 and 1651, we would suggest, is in complete harmony with international law as reflected in UNCLOS, which is the UN Convention on the Law of Seas. And in particular, I would direct the court's attention to UNCLOS Article 101. Article 101C, more particularly and more specifically, precisely mimics Section 2 of domestic code. That is, just as in the context of, for example, a kidnapping.
Not precise.
I'm sorry?
You overstated when you said precise. Essentially, you would argue it's essentially the same concept.
Essentially, I am
precise
prone.
Precise is the wrong word.
I'm prone to hyperbole, Your Honor, and I would suggest
most that's, lawyers are.
I would suggest that's a better characterization. There is a concordance, if you will, between the two. The international law is reflected in UNCLOS in Section 2 and 1651. The operation of Section 2 in 1651 is no different than what this court does and what the United States recognizes in its indictments every day. Not every participant need have committed, if you will, the jurisdictional triggering element. In this context, the jurisdictional triggering element is the high seas requirement. We are not for one moment suggesting that this court, or did we suggest below, that the district court excise from our reading of the statute the high seas requirement. We understand that we are going to have to go into court at the trial level and demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's Confederates engaged in high seas conduct. They violently seized the ship. Our point is more refined. It's simply that, just as this court has said in Knopfinder, in Raper, the defendant himself need not have satisfied every single element. High seas in that respect is consistent with the lack of requirement that everyone who transports victims across state lines pursuant to the Mann Act, not all of those people have to have crossed state lines physically. The high seas requirement is similar to that. In that respect, the district court thus erred in restricting, and I would suggest severely restricting, the government's theory of liability. The district court has essentially distilled this case down to a 28-minute segment. That is the period of time that we can show via GPS data that the defendant was on the high seas. Indeed, I would suggest the district court has more specifically confined the government's case, because the district court has suggested that even in that 28-minute period, we would have to show affirmative acts of negotiation to meet our aiding and abetting proof standard. Again, we think that's incorrect.
How far do you go on the facilitating? from the definition of privacy, are you saying facilitation could, for example, include before any of this starts, the defendant sat with those who would be on the high seas, planned it, financed it, made some calls to make sure everything was in place? Would that be covered as well, so long as something happened on the high seas by the principals?
Yes.
That's your theory?
Yes, yes. And, of course, we would have significant intent requirements pursuant to any aiding and abetting context, but yes, absolutely. My time is ticking away. I want to make sure.
All right, so we understand your argument on count two. I don't understand your argument on count one. I mean, you're wobbling around in that. Are you essentially saying that's not your strongest one, right?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Let's not let's not waste time there.
Well, are you going to give up on count
one? I'm not, Your Honor. And recognizing there's a weakness inherent in our count one argument, I want to proffer what I consider to be our strongest argument on count two.
On count two?
I'm sorry, count one. I apologize. Eunice is very clear. This court does not have to bend to international law if Congress's intent is clear. In this case, the suggestion is that Congress's intent was not clear. It is clear. Section 371 does not have a carve-out for piracy in violation of the law of nations. Section 371, more specifically, was enacted after the piracy statute. Congress writes with the backdrop of piracy in its sights. The point is that without that carve-out, this is an offense against the United States. It's an offense, indeed, against all nations. It's an offense against Germany. It's an offense against Venezuela.
You couldn't file under 371 alone, right?
I'm sorry?
You couldn't file under 371 alone, right?
Well, and we did.
No, 1651, just 371.
Yes, we could, and we did.
Extraterritorially? Really?
Well, this goes back to Yusuf. It goes back to Eunice. To the extent that the court...
You think your count one could rest on 371 without regard to whether there was a 1651 extraterritorially? There's no case law to support that.
Well, of course, we would have to show that...
You can go after conspiracies anywhere in the world under 371?
If we meet, of course, 371's predicate of an offense against the United States, conspiring to commit an offense against the United States.
Well, that takes you back to 1651.
Of course.
Which says, as defined by the law of nations.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So that's your weakest argument by far.
It is not the strongest argument.
Can you go to the due process for me?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. The court dismissed counts 3 and 4 after initially concluding that counts 3 and 4 met the due process standard and that the defendant was not being treated fundamentally unfairly or arbitrarily.
Counsel, let me tell you what's really bothering me so that I understand your answer. I read the brief several times to make sure I understood what you were doing. You were doing it artfully, but not directly. One of their strong arguments on the due process is all of the stuff that you're raising now about nexus, close connections to the United States, blah, 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 was not raised in the district court. And you kind of blow it off like, well, that kind of waiver notion doesn't come in play here. I don't buy that. I think it does come in play here. And I'm not getting what you're saying. Their argument seems to be forcefully that not only did you not suggest to the district court that there were all of these considerations, the only thing you had to say about it went to the bond stuff, which was he doesn't have any serious connections to the United States. I understand how you want to put that aside because you're talking about that's temporal, that's now as opposed to before. But the before stuff was never played out before the district court.
Your Honor, I 100% agree that we did not precisely argue our contacts point below. Right. We did raise nexus, however, and I think this is just a variation on the theme of nexus. That is... and I want to be very careful here, and I apologize if I'm being obtuse, but in particular, I would direct the court's attention to our brief at pages 53-54 and notes 29 and 30. The material at those portions of our sealed brief, I would suggest, demonstrate that this man had a nexus with the United States.
That was raised previously.
Your Honor, again, there is no doubt that we did not precisely make this point below. We did argue nexus
right,
generally.
Deal with that first. You blew that off in the brief as whatever. So let's assume there may be something to be said. I don't know, but let's assume also my understanding of the record so far is that you didn't raise it.
Well, you know, this is a de novo issue of law. The facts are not disputed on this point. This court can make the determination as well as the district court. And so in that respect, to the extent that we...
Factual determinations?
It's not a factual determination, Your Honor.
The underlying facts to make the determination as to whether or not you reach the conclusion of nexus or contacts. Someone has to make the underlying determination with respect to the facts, right?
Undoubtedly.
And that's the district court's responsibility.
Well, my point is that those facts have never been disputed. In fact, again, if you look at our brief at pages, 53 to 54, you will see that, in fact, these are some of the things that we're relying on the defendant's own admissions. The sealed appendix is...
I understand. It was a very interesting argument. We didn't put it in play, but they never contested it. If on the other side, I mean, so of course I didn't contest it if you didn't put it in play.
Well,
it's a cute argument, but we know you guys well enough to know it's only cute.
I've been accused of many things. Cute is not one of them, Your Honor. But I don't think it's cute.
I don't think it's cute either. I think there's a problem of fairness here.
Well, again, this is a de novo issue.
De novo in deciding what the underlying facts are.
Well,
as a predicate to the legal conclusion. That is absolutely not de novo. We don't make factual findings. I know in some of the cases that we otherwise hear, we're wandering off into that area. It's wrong. That's not what Court of Appeals is supposed to do. District courts are supposed to make factual findings.
Yeah. The other consideration I would put in front of the court is that this was a very quickly unfolding scenario to the extent that the district court initially went with us on the due process grounds and said, yes, you know what, the United States versus Xi decision from the Ninth Circuit controls this case. And it was only when the court considered that we had made some concession about the high seas portion of our brief that the court flip-flopped and went with the due process argument and dumped it. And in that respect, I would suggest...
Let me go on, counsel. There's a much more fundamental question about due process. The courts of appeals are, it seems to me, in dispute as to whether nexus is necessary or not, and whether all that is necessary is notice.
Yes.
So let's assume there is no nexus. Aren't you prepared to argue that notice alone satisfies due process?
Yes. And in fact, we have notice coupled with universal condemnation. That is, United States versus... United States versus Xi stands for that proposition. And so from our perspective, we've met every test that's out there.
Now, how is notice established?
Notice is established... I would suggest two ways. Number one, most critically under the hostage-taking convention, as the district court initially found, the world is put on notice that if you take hostages, then you are committing an act that is universally condemned. And that notice...
You think that's what she says?
That's what she said in her first opinion, yes, Your Honor.
No, the case, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, she, yes.
Yeah, right.
You're right, yes.
Not E, I.
I think she does say that. I think it's an independent ground pursuant to she. There's no doubt that I think in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, how I hear the argument, and Judge Silverman was trying to move you off some weak areas, and so how comfortable are you with that argument? That is, forget nexus and all the rest. Contacts is simply a matter of if there is a convention, we assume the world knows. That's essentially what you're arguing.
Coupled with the universal condemnation in this case of the conduct that he engaged in. That is, as we've demonstrated in the first part of a brief, piracy.
How do we know that it's universally condemned? It's funny because sometimes in U.S. jurisprudence, we're disdainful of these international norms, and now we can find them here?
Well, in this case, 1651 directs you to the Law of Nations. I mean, in that respect, Congress has already picked international norms give you a sense.
Saying here, your hook is 1651 plus the convention.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And, of course, one has to keep in mind, the issue is, or the due process question really raises the issue of whether the statute is unconstitutional as applied.
Right.
Yes.
And that's a very sobering and difficult question.
I do not understand why the nexus issue relates to due process at all, because that's more of a jurisdictional question rather than a due process.
There is a sense in some of the case law that they've taken the civil minimum contacts and imported it into the due process analysis. And in that respect, the question is, would it be fundamentally unfair to say that this man should be hailed into a court in the United States? Again, I think no matter how you slice this due process apple, via universal condemnation versus notice from the hostage-taking convention or via the nexus that we think we've established.
Well, I think as an abstract matter, what you're really talking about when you talk about context and nexus in a situation like that, forget 16-1 exists, is our understanding that you can't just apply our law extraterritorially. And so that referring to context and saying there has to be a nexus somehow suggests we're overcoming that. But you're right. Your answer to that is we have 1651.
Yes.
Which still goes to raises Judge Silverman's question as to whether or not it's a constitutional application, but in any event.
Well, certainly we feel very comfortable with our count two in that respect. The interaction between Section 2 and 1651, we think there's no doubt that's
going to happen. What about counts three and four?
Well, in counts three and four, Congress is acting at the behest of a convention.
You don't feel comfortable about three and four when you say you're comfortable
about I'm sorry. Yes,
no. I wonder whether you're giving away three and four, too.
I'm 110% comfortable with counts three and four.
You got the language on three. If you don't have a due process problem, you've got the language.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yes.
Offender's found in the United States.
Yes.
How did you apprehend this individual?
Your Honor, he came into the United States voluntarily, so we fall into the found-in provision of 1651 and in the hostage-taking sense. I see that my time is well up. If there are more further questions, I will reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. The District Court's decision should be affirmed based on three points of law that are essentially undisputed. First, the extraterritorial reach of an ancillary liability statute is determined by the underlying statute. Second, there is no crime of conspiracy to commit piracy under international law. And third, there is no nexus between the charged conduct and the United States.
All right, so we don't have a big fight so far on one, so don't waste your time there. I don't know how you're answering count two, because if you go to Article 101C, it includes facilitating.
It does not
have a high seas predicate, save that the principals had to have been engaged in piracy on the high seas.
There's a number of points about that are.
I want to get you to what is one of your issues.
Well, I want to start with, first off, it is not equivalent to Section 2, mainly because it, unlike Section 2, which falls within Title 18, Section C of 101 falls within Part 7 of UNCLOS, which starts with Article 86, that says the application of this part is only on the parts of the sea that are not in the territorial seas of a state. So any logical reading of the convention means that this does not apply in the territory of a state, and that includes C, which is an act of facilitation. But an act of facilitation of piracy is not considered some sort of separate offense. It is itself defined as an act of piracy. So one of the things that we pointed out in our brief is that this language actually goes back to 1958 and the adoption of the High Seas Convention. And the drafters...
Which language? 86 or 101?
101. There was no 86 in the High Seas Convention because the name said it all. There was a separate convention covering the territorial seas. And in the process of drafting all of that, the International Law Commission clearly addressed this question, having defined facilitation as itself piracy, just as had been done by Harvard Law School scholars years earlier. They said it only applies on the high seas. So the government has asserted that there's been some sort of conscious choice here to expand the traditional meaning of piracy as a jurisdictional offense to one that includes people who are either 101B, operating a pirate ship, or 101C, facilitating or inciting piracy anywhere in the world, even though there is no judicial decision that anyone has been able to cite in this case or any other where this actually happened, where any state actually applied 101C. in the way that the government is suggesting is reflective of customary international law.
Well, the language of it, the government's argument is twofold. The first of which is the statute is absolutely clear without regard to international law. Incidentally, I appreciate the fact that the government does not use the term that a statute violates international law. I think, notwithstanding an early opinion of the Supreme Court, that is an incomprehensible concept. Our statutes don't violate international law. They supplant international law, number one. And it's, their first argument is the statute is perfectly clear without even looking at international law. Secondly, if you look at the UNCLOS, the international law is quite consistent.
Well, as
the literal language is quite consistent.
I would respect.
And you go to, you know, the Article 86, then, which, and they go back to other provisions of the articles which are inconsistent with your theory. But that's not really much concern because the literal language of the convention is supports them.
Well, that, but Your Honor,
and I don't care what the, notwithstanding my degree, I don't care what the Harvard professors think.
Well, Your Honor, the literal language of Article 101C does not say that it applies everywhere in the world.
Well, wait a minute. You know, I thought you, well, let me hear your answer on this one first. The literal language of 1651 doesn't really support what the government's saying. If
that's
you read it the way the district, I mean, that's the answer to Judge Silverman.
On the statutory
point. But then that means the answer to Judge Silverman is Congress meant to do something short of what international law would allow as he and I are seeing it under the convention. It says whoever on the high seas, your argument is, under U.S. law, which is their count, you have to be on the high seas.
That's right, Your Honor, but we by no means think that international law even means what
no,
the government
but I mean, isn't that the answer to Judge Silverman?
That is
but you're not giving that. He's saying literally the statute covers it, and I was shocked because I thought your answer was literally the statute absolutely does not cover it.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. Judge Silverman covered a lot of ground. I'm sorry, I started with probably the wrong point. But we absolutely believe that the statute here is what is the law. And the statute is, relatively speaking, compared to a lot of the rest of the issues that are being brought up, unambiguous. It says whoever on the high seas. As the district court noted, it doesn't say whoever except for aiders and abettors. And one thing that is pretty consistently clear throughout the Supreme Court's jurisprudence is that boilerplate language like that of Section 2 does not modify the extraterritorial reach of an underlying statute. And so there's no doubt, especially in considering what this statute arose out of, which was the decision by the Supreme Court in United States versus Palmer, that this statute was not meant to apply within the territory of another state, even as to aiders and abettors. The district court went through that history well. But one thing the district court did not notice, perhaps because the government was still sort of blurring the lines at the time about whether or not it would prove high seas conduct, is that this circuit has already decided a similar question in United States versus Yaku. That case held that the breadth of Section 2, aiding and abetting, does not operate to expand the extraterritorial reach of a statute. So since there's no dispute that this statute does not apply to principals anywhere but on the high seas, it does not apply as to aiding and abetting either. So
that's
just as
right if you construe whoever on the high seas to mean a person has to actually be on the high seas.
I think that's the right way to read the statute, especially when you look at it as a whole. It's a pretty short statute because it actually doesn't define the elements of the offense at all.
Well, I mean, the thing that causes you to stumble when you're trying to prepare this awful case is commits the crime of piracy as defined by the law of nations.
That's the part that's hard to get over. But what's clear from the statute, though, is that whoever on the high seas commits that crime. And then there's the second, the third part, though, Your Honor.
I understand the first part. I mean, that's... Yeah. The district court's argument is very forceful there, but then what do you do with the rest? Commits the crime of piracy as defined by the law of nations.
Well, you only look to that if you've already found that the person you're trying was on the high seas when he acted. So that's the logical iteration. The government in its reply addresses this issue only in a footnote, and in trying to do so, it takes the on the high seas part and puts it after the definition of crime of piracy, and that's a significant difference.
I forgot to ask him this question when we were up here, because that is the problem on count two that has troubled me all along, because this literal language looks like it it undercuts. It's not what we normally see in this case. It looks like it's narrower than the international law, if the international law is what it appears to be in 101. Now, I understand your argument is appearances are wrong there, too. Right. Now, if that's right, then you really have a strong argument on count two, because you're saying even if you get to 101, it doesn't matter, because that's not 101. Facilitation doesn't mean that.
Yes, Your Honor. And one thing I'd like to address is looking to the literal text of just 101, even if you take it out of its context of Articles 86, but also 100 and 105, which the government scarcely addresses, that actually covers universal jurisdiction. Article 101 does not specify any geographical constraint as to where the actual pirates are. It only specifies in 101A that the act be directed on the high seas or in another place outside the jurisdiction of another state. So that would theoretically include someone who was on shore shooting out to sea, as long as they were in a ship or a member of a ship's crew. So that is not the reasonable interpretation of the statute. That's not what, or the convention rather. There's no evidence that anyone meant to have that become a universal jurisdiction offense. And the government is forced to excise the word directed in order to make an argument here that there's some sort of geographical constraint that was intentional in A, but not in B or C. Additionally, 101B is leads to an incredibly absurd result where the government's central point that no one is doubting that there has to be some act on the high seas is undercut by that, because 101B makes cross-reference to 103, the sum being that if you're on a ship and you're intentionally helping operate that ship and you want to go out to the high seas either to commit an act of piracy or to facilitate one, then that in itself is an act of piracy. And so if everything in Article 101 is universal jurisdiction piracy, that means that as long as you're on a ship with that intent, you don't even have to go onto the high seas to be subject to it. And that's an absurd result, because it undermines the essential nature of piracy. And it's really, I think, just wrong and borders on ridiculous to say that this sort of conscious choice was made without any reference to it whatsoever by the drafters.
My understanding of your view, if I'm operating or I'm a Somali entrepreneur and I'm operating a mothership just inside territorial waters, sending out small craft to do the piracy, that I am not covered by this statute.
That's correct. Not by this statute. It's a matter of universal jurisdiction.
And also not covered under the Law of Nations.
101. It's not Law of Nations piracy is what it is. Nonetheless, it's not as if those people would be immune from suit or from prosecution by all the states that are affected by their conduct. That's the traditional basis of jurisdiction, and it's fairly wide. You know, the necessary nexus could be had with any number of countries and this conduct, but the United States is not one of them. So that's the issue, is that it's a matter of where universal jurisdiction arises, and it's only from high seas conduct. And if you look to a lot of the due process cases that are at issue, sort of turning to the next issue, it actually reinforces the notion that the high seas are a different area than the territory of a state. And so a lot of the cases which have found due process without a specific nexus have focused on the fact that it was a stateless vessel on the high seas, or at least on the high seas committing an act of piracy. So what the case United States versus Xi, the principal holding of that, says is that where it's a universal jurisdiction offense, the nexus requirement is nil. And that's the holding that the government sort of skirts over in its briefs. It appears to have, at oral argument here, asserted that it still has to prove there was a piracy before it can get to counts 3 and 4. And we actually wouldn't disagree with that. If the conduct is piracy, as defined by the Law of Nations, then it would be a universal jurisdiction offense. But the problem is, hostage taking is not a universal jurisdiction offense.
Yeah, but the statute, you're just walloped by the statute. So you want us to declare the statute unconstitutional.
Only as applied to individuals who, there's really two ways to go about this. One of the arguments presented to the district court below was that the statute itself, you know, applying the Charming Betsy doctrine, you could read it to say that even though it seems to unambiguously apply to anyone in the world, that Congress wouldn't have intended that to mean someone who had no nexus to the U.S., and in the case of found in jurisdiction, was, say, brought here or tricked to come here, because one of the things that the government lawyer did not mention is that Mr. Ali was actually tricked into coming here by the United States, and that's one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of reference to how he got here or to the found in language in their briefs. They've not relied on that as a basis for due process being sufficient here. Judge Silberman asked whether there was a need for a nexus in a case, and I think that the answer is that the courts that have looked at it have generally said yes, except in some circumstances where it otherwise comported with international law. We know of no case where any other circuit has said that in the absence of either a nexus or compliance with a valid basis of prescriptive jurisdiction under international law, that the case could go forward. So notice is not the issue here. Notice doesn't comport with due process. It's about having a valid basis of authority. So before a state can bring...
Well, that sounds like jurisdiction when you say valid basis of authority. That doesn't sound like a due process question at all.
Well, jurisdiction is a word that's used in a lot of contexts. And we're not talking about subject matter jurisdiction. We're talking about jurisdiction or sort of valid lawful authority to impose the coercive power of the state. And when the Supreme Court has addressed jurisdictional questions like this in civil cases, there's been little doubt that it has used the due process clause in doing so. So jurisdiction over the defendant and over the conduct is a part of due process. And it does have some relationship not to notice about whether the conduct was criminal, but to whether one would reasonably anticipate being hailed into court. Because if you know that your conduct didn't have any impact on Trinidad and Tobago, and then you went on vacation there and they arrested you for something that you did in the U.S., had been investigated for and cleared for, you'd be very surprised, because what does that country have to do with it? And so that's one of the problems.
Except, there's a simple answer to that. That is, you have reason to have good notice, because the country has passed the statute that says a statute is passed pursuant to an international norm. And so if you walk in this country having violated that international norm, we will arrest you.
Right, but the issue is not just notice. It would not make it fair.
The answer to what you just said, being shocked, you shouldn't be shocked.
Well,
if there is a statute in the country and it's passed pursuant to an international norm and you decide to come into that country.
Well, regardless of the shock element,
that was your argument, not mine.
I don't read every statute before I go to visit another country.
Well, I understand, but you understand where
nobody I understand where you're coming
from. Nobody reads every statute even when they are in existence in the country itself. That's not a fair.
So that's problem. Where it comes down to what is.
So so the problem is, what about the person you're represented came into this country? Doesn't matter whether he's tricked or not. He came into this country. Therefore, why isn't he on notice, just as an American citizen would be, as to our law?
Well, Your Honor, the government has not articulated this as a basis for finding a nexus or
No. They did say notice.
Notice.
But the issue is.
I don't think
this is not the issue here.
From your point of view.
Well,
I'm not sure nexus has any bearing on the due process clause. I don't care. I notice some courts have said it. Others have said no. And the only thing I can pull out of the due process clause that's even relevant here is a concept of notice. Fairness is notice.
Well, Your Honor, every court, though, that has looked at it, I don't think any of them have said that in the absence of nexus that you can just say that because the United States is able to have this person here, that there's jurisdiction.
Well, that is nexus in a sense. He walked into this country with notice.
But not with notice that the United States would prosecute him for offenses that were conducted beforehand.
That he walked into a country that had passed a law making his conduct criminal.
Well, Your Honor, I want to take on one point because it's important.
Is that the government not correct?
It's correct that he has walked into a country that says hostage-taking is criminal, but...
That his prior hostage-taking was criminal.
Well, I don't think that's correct. It would require, I think, going into certain sealed material to get into the details on that. But the point is, the government has not advanced this exact theory, and it's something where, if it had, we could have addressed it more thoroughly in the briefs, but there's a considerable body of case law, at least in the civil context, that says that tricking someone is not a valid basis for sort of tagged in jurisdiction, which is, I think, along the lines of what you're talking about. Because regardless of personal jurisdiction over the defendant, the fact that he's found here, there has to be a valid basis for saying that the coercive power of this state can be applied to the defendant for the conduct at issue. And that's what makes it fair, is the fact that there's a valid basis of prescriptive jurisdiction. Consider the Supreme Court's decisions in McIntyre and Goodyear made it evident that you can't just use sort of free-form notions of fairness when there's no valid lawful authority for the government to be prosecuting the individual, or in those cases,
it seems
suing.
To me you're the one who's using fair. This whole concept of due process is based on a free-floating notion of fairness.
No, Your Honor, it's grounded heavily in international law and the bases of prescriptive jurisdiction. And that's the nexus test is essentially the same test as the valid bases of prescriptive jurisdiction, whether U.S. interests are affected. And the reason why that has to be a focus is because when a country has no interest in prosecuting a particular crime, and you balance that against the defendant's interests in not having substantial pretrial delay, not being subjected to the strong possibility of double jeopardy.
Interest pursuant to the convention they signed and passed the statute pursuant to that. They, with other international actors, who said, this is a serious problem across the world, and we're going to take steps. We agree with you to take steps. The existence of that convention and our agreement to join it is very significant, I think.
Well, what about the significance of the fact that this convention is not still creating a universal jurisdiction of offense? Mr. Ali's country, Somalia, has not signed onto that convention. One of the reasons very well is because...
But it isn't a universal jurisdiction question here.
Well, our position...
It's a statutory proscription here, and it's based on, and part of the argument is, it comes from our agreement. If there wasn't an underlying convention, then one might wonder. But there is an underlying convention that we signed on to.
Our position, Your Honor, is that the existence of a convention merely, especially a convention which is not uniformly adopted, is not enough for due process, because you still, as every circuit has addressed it, you still need a valid basis for saying that the United States is going to prosecute this crime. It's going to supplant its moral judgment for that of other states that have looked into this question. And that's the issue. The United States has routinely, in other contexts, opposed applications of international conventions exactly like this when the United States has not signed on to it. It would be no more fair, specifically I'm referring to the American Service Members Protection Act. And so to have that be the U.S. policy and then to not follow that when the U.S. is prosecuting other people is unfair. And
is that a decision that you, is that an argument that you present to the Justice Department rather than to this court?
No, Your Honor, because...
You understand what I'm saying.
I understand that it's a matter of policy, and...
Right. It's
but
a prosecutorial discretion question.
It factors into that, policy. But it does factor into fairness. And, moreover, the U.S. government's...
I don't know that it... Well, now you're in this free-floating area.
Well, right? No, because, Your Honor, the U.S. government specifically said in its testimony and objections to certain conventions that they thought it violates international law. So that's the issue here, is the international law of prescriptive jurisdiction governs when it's fair for a country to impose its coercive power on a defendant. And that's what's important, is that without having that basis in international law, that recognized authority, it's not fair for that country to say Mr. Ali is guilty when Somalia, Denmark, and the countries that are actually affected by it have said they don't want to prosecute him. If there are no further questions, I see my time is expired.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Definitely have a question.
Yeah. Your Honor, I know I've run over my time, and I just have 2 points very briefly.
Oh, no, you got to. I'm assuming one of your points is.
I wanted to address your question.
I'm sorry, I apologize, because 1651 literally does not, so if you read it the way it's written, it does not support your position.
I disagree. 2 points, Your Honor. First, you made reference to the suggestion that 1651 is more rigorous / stringent when you compare it to UNCLOS. We agree with that. We can imagine scenarios where a piracy is considered a violation of the UN Convention Against the Law of Seas, but doesn't have that high seas requirement, and in particular, which is definitely in 1651.
Right.
Congress could do that if they wanted to, and they did. You can imagine, in fact, the Eastern District of Virginia in the Hassan decision makes reference to the possibility that, for example, an air piracy which would be a violation of UNCLOS, might not satisfy 1651. Another possibility is if you look at 101B.
Wait, so where does that get us?
Yeah, where are you going?
Don't warm up. Don't you warm up too much. Get to the answer. Where are you going with it?
The answer is that we agree that there is a high seas requirement. But our point is that just like in every other federal statute, not every person has to satisfy that high seas requirement. You know, a kidnapping does not lose its federalness.
No, that's where you mean the aiding and abetting avoids it?
Absolutely.
Oh, no. Then that the case law in this circuit says otherwise. I mean, that's just not correct.
Your Honor, aiding
and abetting statute is not so broad as to expand the extraterritorial reach of the underlying statute. And if your underlying statute says the extraterritorial reach is only on high seas, you can't use aiding and abetting to make a... We're clear on that. You cannot enlarge that. That's the hard part of this case. You absolutely cannot avoid that. And that's where Judge Revelle was right.
We are not suggesting that Section 2 enlarges.
It does enlarge it.
It doesn't, Your Honor, to the extent that Section 2 simply says what a kidnapping...
The way you're arguing Section 2 and the way you're arguing 101, it would be enlarging it. You have to satisfy the high seas requirement. The case law on what aiding and abetting means in all kinds of contexts, you can't enlarge the principal reach of a statute.
We satisfy the high seas requirement by showing that an aider and abettor with principals who engaged in high seas conduct violated the statute. We are not suggesting that we don't have to come into court and show high seas conduct. We do. Our point is that consistent with Nofsinger and this court's decision in Raper, when an aider and abettor facilitates that high seas crime, that's the end of the analysis. I would suggest this would be the first statute.
Nofsinger says every person. It's different. I mean, you're walking right into the buzzsaw now. I mean, I've looked at all these cases, and you cannot go, because this is what threw me off when I started preparing this. Those cases don't help you because their reach is clear. If you look at Yakow, it's just the opposite. That's the case. Yakow versus Nofsinger is right. That's the good conjunction to look at. And you lose on that conjunction because Nofsinger's reach for principle, it says every person.
Your Honor, I would suggest that this would be the first court to hold that absolutely every participant in a crime have to have satisfied the jurisdictional triggering element. If you commit a kidnapping, not every person has to transport the victim in interstate or foreign commerce. That's all that we're suggesting happens here. The principals will satisfy the high seas requirement. They were aided and abetted by the defendant. That is how Section 2 works with 1651. That's how Section 2 works with Section 1201. It's how Section 2 works with 1203. That is entirely consistent.
Judge Edwards is suggesting, and I'm puzzled by this, that whatever would be appropriate construction under domestic law, which you're clearly right, doesn't apply when it's extraterritorial. I think that's his point, is it not? I'm not sure. What about his cases that he cites?
How do you deal with Yakow?
Yakow, I think, is a very, very, very different case. Yakow says it only reaches U.S. persons wherever found. It expressly delimited a class of persons. And if you look at Yakow and the ITAR, which is the statute that the implementing regulations, it said it only reaches U.S. persons. They didn't have a U.S. person there. End of discussion under Yakow. Right. That is not our case.
Yeah, your case, it only reaches whoever on the high seas.
And
that's exactly the point.
Your Honor.
Yakow says exactly what you said, and this is whoever on the high seas.
Your Honor, it does not take out a class of persons. Clearly, Congress in Yakow, as interpreted by Yakow, had a sense that there were certain persons who would not be subject to extraterritorial jurisdiction. That is not what 1651 does. 1651, just like the kidnapping statute, says whoever takes someone across interstate lines violates the statute. It doesn't lose its federalness, if you will, simply because not all the participants drove the person across state lines. a piracy does not lose its universalness just because every single person didn't go on the high seas.
We're not talking about 101. We're talking about 1651. You keep switching. 1651 says whoever on the high seas commits the crime.
I understand. Just as the kidnapping.
That's the limiting consideration with respect to the U.S. statute. And you'd like to be able to go to 101 and argue that 101 broadens 1651, but I don't see anything to support that.
I'm not suggesting that 101 broadens it. I'm suggesting that every statute in the federal code has a limiting principle. The kidnapping statute says you must transport somebody in interstate commerce. But that doesn't mean that every person has to do that. Just as the statute here says whoever on the high seas doesn't mean that Mr. Ali had to be on the high seas. This court, if it were to take the position of the district court, what I would suggest would be taking the position that contrary to every federal statute that I know of, you are saying that every single person has to satisfy every single element. That's not what the cases say, and that's not what this section says when you consider it in particular, I would suggest, with unclosed Article 101.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goodham. The case will be submitted. We are adjourned.